You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin native shares some of her latest poetry, including works inspired by the pandemic and the natural world. But first, it's the first libel case against the New York Times to go to trial in nearly two decades, and it was just thrown out by the judge this afternoon before the jury could reach a verdict. Brought by Sarah Palin, the former Republican governor of Alaska and 2008 vice presidential candidate, she said the New York Times defamed her in an editorial where they incorrectly linked her and her super PAC with a mass shooting in Arizona. Now, will the appeals process pave the way to a Supreme Court that has signaled that they may be inclined to revisit libel laws in the United States? And what's next, then, for Sarah Palin versus the New York Times? Journalists are watching because it may portend what's next for them. We want to know what you think about this case at 1-800-642-1234, whether or not you've been following it, what you think about the judge's decision to throw out the case before the jury had a chance to weigh in. Are libel laws in the U.S. good the way they are, or do they need some updates? What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. Always email us. Ideas at WPR.org. Enrique Armijo is a professor of law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina, an expert on First Amendment and media law. Enrique, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Lee.
So a lot of news on this story today, but to start, and can you just lay out what is at issue in this case and what may be at stake ultimately?
Sure. And you laid it out well in your intro, Lee. Basically, what happened was that the New York Times published an editorial in 2017 after the congressional shooting at the Ellipse in Washington. And it was really about denouncing demonization of political opponents on both sides of the aisle. And as you also said in the intro, in that article, the initial draft of that article didn't reference Sarah Palin's PAC at all, but in a revision of that article, the editorial page editor, whose name was James Bennett, added this connection between the Gabby Gifford shooting, which took place in 2011, and a poster that Sarah Palin's PAC put out that had gunshot sites on certain congressional districts, including Congresswoman Giffords. And then James Bennett, the line that he added, said that there was no sign of incitement in the 2017 example as there was in 2011. Pretty soon after this comes out, almost immediately, the New York Times goes through this kind of internal debate and discussion about whether it was right, the reference that the Sarah Palin PAC poster had incited the Gabby Gifford shooting, whether or not that was accurate. And basically, about 14 hours after the editorial initially runs on the New York Times website, that line is taken out. So really what Sarah Palin sought to do is say that the New York Times should be liable for a mistake. The mistake here being, as I said, claiming a connection between the poster and the Gifford shooting. And what Judge Rakoff said really just about an hour ago was that a mistake wasn't enough, that under the First Amendment, what Governor Palin had to show was what's known as actual malice, which is a technical term in defamation law. It comes from a case in 1964 called New York Times versus Sullivan that says that when the person bringing a defamation claim, when the plaintiff is a public official or public figure, they have to show that the defamatory statement was made with knowledge of its falsity or with reckless disregard as to whether or not it was true. And what Judge Rakoff basically said this afternoon was that Governor Palin had put forth no evidence that that Mr. Bennett knew that what he said about her was false, that this was just a mistake. Mr. Bennett even said on the stand that he regretted making the mistake, but that wasn't enough under the First Amendment for the New York Times to be liable for defamation.
Enrique Armijo, our guest, professor of law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina. And so while the judge threw out Sarah Palin's case against the New York Times earlier today, jury deliberations are continuing despite the judge's ruling. Enrique, why is this?
Well, it's certainly odd for Judge Rakoff to have basically announced his decision, his judgment. The technical term here is judgment notwithstanding the verdict. So what that means is that the New York Times is going to win regardless of what the jury says. But what Judge Rakoff said in open court today was that he is certain that Governor Palin is going to appeal. As you also said in your intro, there's this kind of climate around the actual malice standard that is open for debate. As you also said in the open, the Supreme Court, or at least two members of the Supreme Court, seem open to it. So what he wants to do is give the appellate courts the benefit of the jury's findings of fact with respect to what the New York Times did and didn't do. So for that reason, he basically is permitting the jury to continue to deliberate. And really, you know, it's a little bit ironic at this point that the only people who don't know that Judge Rakoff is going to throw out this case are those jurors that are deliberating right now.
Oh, wow. So and the two justices on the Supreme Court that are Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, but also through some tough media firestorms, the appointments of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. What would your take be if this were appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and how the current makeup of the Supreme Court may come down on this issue of libel in 2022?
Well, it's certainly true that if for Governor Palin to win, the Supreme Court is going to have to change the law. And it's the only court in the federal system that can do that, right? The lower courts are constrained by Supreme Court precedent and other precedent to follow the law. You know, Judge Rakoff even kind of made some statements this afternoon that, you know, it pains me to hold this way, but the law is forcing me to hold this way. And if I were the New York Times, I would be a little bit worried. You know, it takes four justices to hear a case. As you already said, we have two that we know what they think, that they want to reconsider this. And then we have another two, as you also said, that haven't really spoken on this issue. But there is a lot of momentum towards kind of revisiting this idea that it should be really hard for public people to sue for defamation. And Judge Gorsuch, in his recent opinion on this, talks about the fact that, and you can agree with him or not, but what he says is that the media is very different than it was in 1964. It would be kind of ironic to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan in a case that also involves the New York Times. but that, you know, because as I said, you know, what Gorsuch talks about a lot in his, you know, in his opinion is the idea that the media is not the institutional media. There's a lot more fact checking. The internet has caused defamation plaintiffs to be false and loose with the truth. There's a lot more defamation out there. But, you know, the New York Times is going to have to be prepared to defend not just the result in this case, but also the rule in Sullivan that makes it harder for them and other media outlets to be sued for defamation.
Enrique Armijo, I am a journalist in a world that has changed our libel laws as we see them as a result of this case in the not so distant future. If our libel laws were to change as a result of this case, ultimately based on appeal and potentially going all the way to the Supreme Court, what changes for journalists?
Well, it's important to point out that the when we talk about the media, and I get the Gorsuch did mention this in his recent opinion, we're not just talking about the New York Times. You know, Fox News and One America News and Newsmax are all being sued. Your listeners might know, by Dominion Voting Systems for some statements that were made on those television stations by guests and hosts with respect to some false statements about Dominion and its involvement in some false allegations about its involvement in rigging the election. In all of those cases, all of those media outlets are relying on the actual malice standard. So in other words, Fox News is saying, we have to be able to report on the fact that that the president of the United States is claiming that the election was rigged. And that involves reporting what the president and others are saying about Dominion voting systems. If we're only reporting, we're not reporting with actual malice. So what the defenders of the actual malice standard have said and are going to say is that in the absence of this extra protection, we're going to be less likely to do things like write about editorials of the kind the New York Times wrote. We're going to be less likely to report on public figures and public officials. And the net result of that is less commentary. And that's really what the First Amendment is intended to protect and promote.
Our guest, Enrique Armijo, professor of law at Elon University in North Carolina. He stays with us for a closer look at the former Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times, a case thrown out by a judge this afternoon, but that may continue on appeal and the jury continues to deliberate in that case. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about libel laws as they stand now in the U.S.? Do they need to be changed, scaled back? Would you like to see stronger protections for journalists? What questions do you have for our guest about how libel laws work and your First Amendment rights? 1-800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up on our look at libel laws in the U.S. and what's at stake in a libel lawsuit against the New York Times that was thrown out by a judge today, but may certainly continue on appeal. We want to hear from you, your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this afternoon is Enrique Armijo. He's a professor of law at the Elon University School of Law. And Enrique, I'm curious what your takeaway was from some of the testimony in this case, the testimony of Sarah Palin in the New York Times in the first libel case of the New York Times to go to court in about 20 years. It promised to open up and expose the process of newsmaking and editorializing inside the New York Times. What did we learn?
Yeah, I think if those who are following the trial closely might have found that, you know, the process of writing an editorial at the old gray lady, the great New York Times, is a lot messier than they might have thought. You had the editorial page editor, right? The person who was in charge of the editorials at the Times, writing a time-sensitive, on-deadline column, or supervising the writing of a column, and putting things in the column, putting facts in the column that were not entirely supported either by his own research or by things that the newspaper itself had reported. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, Mr. Bennett got on the stand and said that this was a mistake and this was my fault. But the strategy of the New York Times lawyers, and the successful strategy, as we saw today, was that the mistake is not enough. The Palin strategy here was to kind of show that the New York Times was biased against her, that this was part of the kind of the liberal media versus the conservative heartland, that they looked down on her, that they thought less of her, that they thought she was a gun nut, and that was enough to kind of supply this mental state that the standard of actual malice requires. But at the end of the day, they didn't really have any facts. They didn't develop any facts that tended to show, again, that Mr. Bennett knew that what he was writing was false. At most, he didn't know it was true. He kind of let his rhetorical flourishes get the best of him. He quickly regretted that. You know, there are text messages and email messages late that night and early in the morning, Mr. Bennett communicating with the reporter Elizabeth Williamson, who wrote the column, communicating with Ross Douthat, who's this very prominent conservative editorial page writer at the New York Times, that basically said to Mr. Bennett in an email, "I don't think what you said is right." And then you had this kind of scramble on the part of Mr. Bennett trying to write this wrong, which he admitted was wrong, but he didn't write this knowing that it was false. And for purposes of actual malice, that's what Sarah Palin needed to show by clear and convincing evidence. And as we've said, Judge Rakoff said she wasn't able to do that.
And the Supreme, or at least two members of the Supreme Court, have at least suggested that they'd be willing to revisit that. So what happens to this case next, Enrique?
Well, Governor Palin, as Judge Rakoff said in court today, she is going to appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is also in New York City. That's the kind of federal court of appeal that hears trial court, hears appeals of trial court decisions in the Southern District of New York. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals is going to side with Judge Rakoff. You know, based on the current law, I don't think there's really anything that they're going to be able to help Governor Palin here. And then, as we said earlier, what Governor Palin is going to try to do is appeal to the Supreme Court for an actual change in the law.
And we'll see if they take that case up. Let's go quickly to Erica in Lake Tomahawk. While we're short on time, I want to get this question in. Erica, you're on with Enrique Armijo.
Hello.
Hi.
I would just like to kind of know, where is the line drawn with some clown like Tucker Carlson, or a clown like our ex-president, who seems to be able to say pretty much anything and call it entertainment? I mean, could could this editorial writer say, "Oh, I was just fooling around"?
Eric, I appreciate the question because it goes to the heart of this case to some degree. I mean, where do you draw that line, Enrique?
Then that's actually some of the critiques about the actual malice standard I think are justified, because what they require, as the caller kind of implied, is the state of mind with respect to the person who made the statement. And, you know, our you know, it's the former president, whatever you think of him, certainly in his mind believed the things that he said were true. So, you know, by his lights, you know, he's never made a false statement. If all you can go by, all you can look at to decide whether or not something is true or false is the subjective police of the subjective state of mind of the person saying it. So it does create real evidentiary problems for defamation plaintiffs to try to find through some other evidence whether or not someone actually thought what they were saying was true.
Yeah, in our last
so
60
it is a
seconds,
robust defense.
I'm curious, you know, as a professor of law and a specialist in the First Amendment rights, where could we, how could we begin to redefine what libel could mean outside of the actual malice standard?
I think the way if libel law is going to change, I think we need to look more at the damages side. You know, I think there are good arguments you could make that this case was never really brought, but the never should have been brought. The reason it never should have been brought is because Sarah Palin never was able to make any definitive statement with respect to any opportunity she lost or any monetary damages that she had as a result of this case. So one thing we could do is make defamation plaintiffs have very strong evidence of actual damages that they've suffered as a result of defamatory statement, and that might narrow the potential liability of the media to those cases in which their statements have really, their false statements have really caused defamatory harm.
And one of the evidences that was brought in by the defense for the New York Times was Sarah Palin's appearance on The Masked Singer on Fox after the editorial came out.
Yeah, and she's, it is interesting, you know, she does seem to have had kind of a semi-retreat from public life, but I don't think anybody in the courtroom was persuaded that that was a result of what the New York Times had written about
Enrique,
her in this editorial.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Enrique Armijo teaches about media and First Amendment law at the Elon University School of Law in North Carolina, on with us to talk about the judge's decision earlier today to throw out Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times and what could happen next if the case is appealed. Now, political polarization of the pandemic hasn't spared Wisconsin school boards. Mass disputes and unruly crowds shut down meetings. Board members faced recalls, and some have resigned over threats. That's led to charged local primaries. Tomorrow, Madeline Fox has more.
Kathy Olig's first campaign to be a Menominee Falls school board member in 2019 feels simple now.
I purchased some yard signs. I talked to people about voting. I participated in the candidate forum. There was just one, and everything kind of went fairly smoothly.
But this year, there are 8 candidates for 3 open slots in Menominee Falls, so she's competing in our first primary.
I think that the schools have been put under scrutiny as a result of what's happening nationally.
That's true in a lot of communities, especially in the suburbs.
You know, as a former school board member, I ran 4 times. 2 I ran without any competition, and 2 I ran with a lot of competition. I think it ebbs and flows.
Terry Phillips is the executive director of the Southeast Wisconsin Schools Alliance. She says that while school board positions are nonpartisan, politics are playing a bigger role.
There are board members who are conservative Republicans who are being contested because they're not conservative enough, apparently. And so that's been so interesting to watch.
Part of that may have to do with national conservative groups looking to regain ground in increasingly competitive suburbs. Vladimir Kogan is a political science professor who studies state and local politics at Ohio State University.
Part of this is, I think, you know, a really rational and strategic effort by, I would say, primarily Republicans who see this opportunity, and probably rightly, right, that this, I do think this is a great opportunity for Republicans to win back suburbs that historically have been pretty red, but now are more and more blue.
Many primary candidates got involved over concerns about how their district was handling COVID-19. But they're getting a boost from national parties and political action committees, which can provide money, strategy, and help gathering signatures and getting the word out. Those were at play in the unusually large wave of recalls over the last 2 years. 17 districts saw recall attempts, including one against Butternut School Board member Gary Murdig in northern Wisconsin, who defeated a December challenge.
It kind of split the community a little bit, which is unfortunate because there are the pro-mask and anti-mask folks.
Murdig isn't up for election until next year, but Butternut will have school board primaries this year for other seats, which has been a rarity during his 31 years on the board.
I'm trying to think the last time we would have had a primary for school board. It's been a long time.
Murdig and others watching rural schools say board meetings are drawing fewer angry community members these days, but some wonder if debates over critical race theory will bring them back. Vladimir Kogan, the Ohio State political scientist, said school board clashes over national hot-button issues aren't new. Sex education, the Common Core, evolution, and voucher programs all cause similar uproar.
You know, there's always national conversations about education, but those are in the past were counterbalanced by local conversations about local issues. And I think that counterbalancing is going away.
There are fewer local newspapers to send reporters to school board meetings, so many communities don't know enough about local issues to take the focus off national debates. But Murdig says most school board business is local or deals with thorny regulatory questions, which can be frustrating for politicized candidates that win elections.
Once in a while, we'll have an issue that would have come up over the years, and sometimes it spurs interest in certain people running for the board, and they become a one-issue candidate. And then as soon as they get on the board, they kind of lose interest.
After the primaries narrow the field in some districts, all the school board races will go to general election on April 5th. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, coming up tomorrow morning on The Morning Show, what do you know about the Wisconsin Supplier Diversity Program? Kate Archer Kent talks with the president and CEO of a Wisconsin company about the state's purchasing power and the value of prioritizing diversity. That's tomorrow morning right here on the Ideas Network. And then join us for Central Time tomorrow afternoon as we take you to the most fun you can have below freezing. I don't know where that is yet, but we're going to find it for you before we get to tomorrow. Also tomorrow, the latest on the hunting of gray wolves. They're back on the endangered species list, at least for now. And we'll find out what that might mean for future wolf hunts in Wisconsin. Also tomorrow on Central Time, no-knock warrants. After a 22-year-old black man was shot and killed by a Minneapolis SWAT team during the execution of a no-knock warrant last week, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at how they're being used in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow, starting at 3, right here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. And if that's not enough, join us tomorrow night. WPR brings you, starting at 7 o'clock, live coverage of the 2022 State of the State Address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. It'll be followed by a Republican response from State Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux, and it'll be hosted by WPR's own Sean Johnson, along with PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. That is the 2022 State of the Union Address by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, and it's tomorrow night at 7, right here on WPR. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn about hard water sailing. It's a winter sport that involves ice, adrenaline, and a good strong breeze. Now, there are many reasons why someone turns to consuming or creating poetry. For our next guest, the natural world and the Midwest have been enduring sources of inspiration and motivation to write. Janet Ruth Heller's president of the Michigan College English Association. She previously served as president of the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature and spent decades teaching writing courses and women's studies at numerous higher education institutions. She's an author and playwright and a Wisconsin native. Her fourth and latest book of poetry is called Nature's Olympics. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, the pleasure is ours. And I want to start by just asking about, and it's a personal question, because sometimes I look at my writing from just a few years ago and I embarrass myself and nobody else needs to even see it. But your new volume of poetry contains works that go back to when you were an undergrad. Why did you want to collect these works that take place over such a span of time?
Well, I'm a big saver. So I've saved all of my work since high school. And while I think I've become a better writer over the years, but I've gone back to some of my earlier work and it surprises me. I mean, there are really some good images. I started writing haiku poems in high school when I was in Milwaukee, and I continued when I was a student at University of Wisconsin-Madison and a graduate student there. And one of the poems I'm going to read you today, I wrote when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I revised it a little bit, but it's basically the same poem that I wrote when I was in my 20s.
All right, well, let's not hold back then. Please, Janet Ruth Heller, bring us one of those poems.
Okay, it's called Snow Poem. Languid flakes cover familiar images, bringing me metaphors in crystalline form. trees resemble giant white flowers. Among their branches, light plays hide and seek. Fog bites off the heads of distant buildings like a hungry dragon. Snow arches over windows and doors, sketching bushy eyebrows and mustaches. Cars huddle like moles, blinded by the storm. Bicycles become cubist statues. Like a witch, I hoard all the images for my winter brew.
Janet Ruth Heller with her poem, Snow Poem, from her new book of poetry, Nature's Olympics. Janet, the imagery is undoubted. You can't deny it. But it also harkens back to the Midwest and the changing of the seasons, which your book of poetry has chapters for all seasons. How is that nature and the main theme of these poems? How have your views on the natural world changed over these times?
I don't think my views have changed all that much. I've always found nature a source of comfort and fascination. My dad would take me for walks when I was a little kid, and he'd say, you know, this is an oak tree, and that's a deer, and that's a squirrel. And he really gave me his love of nature. And that has lasted my whole life. I'm 72 now. So, I think there's been very little change. I think my love of nature has just deepened. And as I've gotten older, I've done research about different birds and animals and plants. So I certainly know more than I used to when I was a toddler and first started taking walks with my dad.
And has the pandemic defined or redefined what reading and writing poetry does for you?
Well, nature has certainly been a comfort during the pandemic. And in the early days of the pandemic, when we couldn't go to many public places, I would take walks outdoors, and the natural world seemed to be ignoring the pandemic. And it was sort of amusing and comforting and sort of a source of stability at a time of trauma.
That the natural world in some ways became a natural escape for the pressing feeling of the pandemic that was surrounding us.
Yes, and when I would take walks, I would encounter other people. There are trails near me for bicyclists and hikers, and I would run into many people on the trail and say hi, and I make some new friends, and it's very pleasant.
Janet Ruth Heller, what recommendations would you make for other people to get into reading or writing poems?
I think it's a good idea to write as often as possible. Many writers, including me, keep a journal, and that way you can write about your ideas each day. And I use many of the details from my journals in my poems. In general, writing as often as possible is a good idea. And also, I'm involved in a writer's group that meets every month. And it motivates me to make sure that I have something written for the group. And I think that's good. And I also get very good feedback from the other professional writers in the group. We all are published writers, and we give one another solid, constructive criticism. And I find that very useful. Many of the poems in Nature's Olympics I've revised with the help of my writers group.
And finally this afternoon, Janet Ruth Heller, if we could go out on a warm note and usher in some spring, would you be able to read something for us from your book's spring section?
Sure. This poem is called Disorientation, and it's about some animals we saw in our backyard. All June, a doe bounds into our yard at midday and stays for an hour. Have heavy rains confused her nocturnal clock? The doe devours violet leaves, beheads hosta, roses, lilies, and phlox. Why is she so hungry? Why does she tarry here? Then one afternoon, she gallops across our lawn, and trotting behind her, a tiny fawn.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing your poetry and words with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
Like a witch, I hoard all the images for my winter brew. Janet Ruth Heller is president of the Michigan College English Association. She's talked with us today about her most recent book of poems, Nature's Olympics. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on an Olympic hopeful from Pulaski.
If you're competing in the biathlon at the Olympics, you have to be really good at not just one, but two sports, Nordic skiing and rifle shooting. Biathlete Deidre Irwin explains.
You skate ski with a modified 22 long rifle that you carry on your back, and you stop on a range and you shoot the targets and hopefully hit them all so you don't have to do any penalty laps.
Irwin is making her Olympic debut as one of 8 members of USA's biathlon team. She's also one of 3 biathletes with Wisconsin ties. Back in high school, the Pulaski native joined the Ashwaubenon Nordic ski team to supplement her running habit. She skied competitively in college, where her friend and current teammate encouraged her to try biathlon. She got hooked, and in addition to being an Olympian, she is also a Vermont National Guard biathlete. I recently talked with Irwin via Zoom while she was in Italy, where her team had just competed in the BMW IBU World Cup.
Good shooting from Didier Irwin.
USA's women's relay team placed 5th, which is the best finish they've had in decades.
What a great day for the American team, 50 seconds behind. I think that was Joanne Reed screaming with joy there as she crossed the line.
I was crying at the end of the relay last weekend, just like so excited, because last year we had a 6th place and we all were like, holy crap, that's crazy. And this year now we have a 5th, and it just sort of sees this progression that our team is able to compete at such a high level throughout the world, even though our sport maybe isn't the most popular in the U.S.
So why do you love competing in biathlon?
One of the reasons that I was really drawn to biathlon was just the passion of all of the administrators I had met and the coaches and the athletes. And then when I actually got to compete internationally at one of my first World Cups, I like walk through this tunnel and then all of a sudden I look over and there's just like 30,000 fans just like screaming and like partying. And it was like being in a football stadium back in Wisconsin. And I'm just like, they're here for us. You know, it was just such a cool thing to experience and see. And then it's also just so challenging. On any day, anybody can clean a race and place so much higher than they normally do.
It's also interesting to me that biathlon has only been in the Olympics for a few decades, because to me, it seems like one of the more practical winter sports. Like at its core, it's extreme survival skills. You ski fast and you shoot.
Yeah. And I think that's why, like for me, it can be part of the military, because it is a military training exercise. That's kind of how it got developed from the Norwegian army to become such a hit. I mean, I think it's the most watched winter sport in Europe.
Can you talk about how you approach a race? It's fascinating to watch how you find that balance between really exerting yourself and racing fast, but not overexerting yourself. Like if you're exhausted, I assume that throws off your shooting.
And that in there lies the question. How do you do that? Because for me, I'm still figuring it out. Every year I've kind of gotten a little bit faster at skiing. And I've noticed that if I do that too much, you're right, I come into the range and I'm a little too breathing too heavy. The barrel's moving a lot more. I can't really get it in sight. So that's really the name of the game, how to balance being efficient and fast in skiing and being able to flip that switch when you get to the range and become a focused precision shooter.
What are your goals with these winter games?
First step was obviously just making it. And since then, I've been able to kind of think about, you know, what kind of realistic goals I can have. So I don't really expect myself to be podiuming or anything in individual events unless something really crazy happens. But I really want to focus on the relays. And I think that our relays are just getting better and better. And I really believe in this group of the 4 women we have here. And I think we can really pull together something magical.
Deidre Irwin is a member of the USA's biathlon team and a Pulaski, Wisconsin native. She'll be competing in at least 3 races at the Olympic Games in Beijing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And coming up, these winter athletes don't mind sliding on the ice either. It's the sport of ice boating, and that's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up later tonight at 6 on 1A+, Why Does Love Hurt? Jen White speaks to a science writer, Florence Williams, on what connects emotional heartache and real physical pain. A love story that matters to anyone who has a heart. Hey, that's me. Plus, The View from Kyiv, that's tonight at 6 on 1A+. Now, you might think sailing is at least a few months out, but there are a group of Wisconsin sailors braving the ice, wind, and snow this winter. Perhaps you've seen them. They're part of a sport called hard water sailing, whose daring participants travel up to 100 miles per hour as they glide over frozen lakes. Joining us to explain ice boating is Commodore Daniel Hearn. He heads up the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club in Madison. And Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want you to take us through the experience of being you out there on that ice. How do the wind, ice, and the boat all interact out there?
Well, of course, ice sailing is a bit of a fickle sport. It's sometimes difficult to get all the factors to line up, but when they do line up, it is an amazing experience. So, of course, first we need ice. We look to have at least 4 or 5 inches, particularly for the larger boats. We're looking for ice that has no to little snow on it. We have to, of course, avoid seams that develop in the ice. We need wind. And then, of course, we need time off work. So add them all up. It's hard to find all those lining up, but it's truly amazing when they do.
Now, you're the Commodore of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club, which has been building and racing boats for more than 100 years. Give us a little bit of a brief history of hard water sailing in Wisconsin.
Well, I'll even go back a little bit further than that. Ice sailing originated in Holland. Originally, they took their summer, their wooden summer boats, and they constructed a platform and dropped their boat right onto the platform and put some runners or skates on it, and they used it for moving stuff around in the winter, and then it became a recreational pursuit as well. When ice sailing began in this country and in Wisconsin, the boats that they were sailing at that time were very large, very heavy, and they were called stern steerers and named because the steering runner was on the stern of the boat. Modern boats, typically the steering is at the front of the boat. They're dramatically lighter. They're built out of composite materials, primarily carbon fiber, and they're very high tech versus the boats that they were sailing 100 years ago. So in Wisconsin, the boats have been sailing on many of the inland lakes for many years, including the Madison Lakes and Lake Geneva and Oshkosh and any of the bigger lakes around the state.
Daniel, how long have you been doing this now?
I started hard water sailing about 2006.
How'd you come across it?
Well, I race catamarans in the summer, and I live in Madison on Lake Monona, and saw the boats out there tearing around, and I thought, wow, that looks like a lot of fun and a way to extend my sailing season. So I checked it out, and before I knew it, I was building my first boat. And now all these years later, I race in 4 different ice boat classes. I'm a builder, so I build a fair number of boats. And not only do I race in Wisconsin and around the U.S., I've also raced internationally as well.
As I understand it, Daniel Hearn, you're actually ranked internationally as of the 2020 Gold Cup, and you've placed in places as far away as Lithuania, Poland, Sweden. Curious what it's been like to go around the globe as a hard water sailor and what you find. What are the like minds that you come across in hard water sailing around the world?
It is truly an international community. Ice sailing has allowed me to forge friendships from all over the world. people who are from, you know, very different walks of life and different cultures, but all sharing a common passion. And it's truly remarkable. I have very good friends in Poland and Sweden and Hungary and Germany and Lithuania and many other, you know, cold weather countries. And typically the sailors are very helpful. It's not easy logistically to get equipment and, you know, travel all over within Europe, for example, to get to where the ice is. And it's a truly remarkable community that helps each other out in that regard.
Daniel Hearn is Commodore of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club, and you can find Daniel racing his ice boat on Madison area lakes and lakes around the world, as mentioned. But just this past weekend, Daniel, a regatta in Madison was canceled because of poor ice and wind conditions. And as you explained this hard water sailing to me, it sounds incredibly dangerous. And you laid out what would be perfect conditions. How often do you come across those conditions in Wisconsin, and how important are they for things like safety?
Well, it typically goes in streaks. The way it works is the lakes further north freeze earlier, and the lakes that are deeper freeze later. So typically the season starts further north in Wisconsin and, you know, up into Minnesota as well. And then as those lakes get snow covered, we're starting to move south and also to the deeper lakes. So if you're willing to travel, you typically get in a very good amount of sailing in a season. If you're unwilling to do that and are just waiting for everything to line up in your backyard, it's a little bit more challenging. But the Madison area or southern Wisconsin is really one of the epicenters of ice sailing in the world. We just happen to have the mix of conditions with the lakes and the temperatures and the amount of snow we get, and that cause it to line up quite well.
Daniel, as I understand it, you're lying down in the boat during these races, and what are you doing to stay safe at speeds that can reach 100 miles an hour?
Well, the position of the skipper in the boat depends on what class of boat you're racing in. You are correct. In the largest ice sailing class in the world, which is called the DN, which is an abbreviation for the Detroit News. That's another whole story. But you are laying down on your back and steering with one arm and pulling a rope, which we refer to as a sheet, with the other arm. And, you know, that boat can go up to, you know, 55, 60 miles an hour. On the other end of the spectrum, a skeeter, which looks very much like a dragster, where the skipper is seated in the middle of the boat, which is 24 to 28 feet long, inside an airplane canopy, so protected from the elements, steering with foot pedals, and the sheet is controlled by a winch inside the cockpit. So it's a broad range of conditions for the skipper, depending on what boat they're in and whether they're completely outside, partially outside, or completely inside.
Daniel Hearn, we're just about out of time, but what's next for you out on the ice before we're done with winter?
Well, the International Skeeter Association Regatta has been called on tentatively for this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on Green Lake in Green Lake, Wisconsin.
Daniel, so I appreciate that. We'll have to leave it there, however, but thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Commodore Daniel Hearn of the Four Lakes Ice Yacht Club giving us an overview of hard water sailing and a preview of what could take place this weekend if conditions allow. We will stay tuned. WPR.